We're talking 100 years of the Packers on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here. 10 decades have passed since the Green Bay Packers were first organized in downtown Green Bay. And since that August day in 1919, the Pack's enduring success has earned legendary status in sports history. So there's a celebration Sunday at Lambeau, and we're taking this hour to look back and reflect on what this organization means to Wisconsin. How long have you been a fan of the Packers? What attracts you to this team versus any other NFL team? Do you have season tickets? What's it like to take in a game at Lambeau? What goes through your head? We're at 800-642-1234 for all things green and gold this hour. Cliff Christie is the Green Bay Packers historian. His hometown is Green Bay, and he spent more than 36 years as a sports writer for the Manitowoc Herald Times, the Green Bay Press Gazette, the Milwaukee Journal, and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Cliff, welcome to the Ideas Network.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Goodness, 100 years is daunting, and that's a lot of moments to take in. And for the historian in you, I imagine there's a lot of winnowing and sifting of what is remarkable to tell and how to get the story right. But let's start with Green Bay itself, the place where really everything begins and remains today. What is magical about Green Bay and this franchise?
Well, I think that, when the Packers were founded in 1919, Green Bay was the sixth largest city in Wisconsin. Superior was bigger. Oshkosh was bigger. So that's part of what makes this such a remarkable story. Also, the second smallest city in the league when it first entered what's now the NFL in 1921. The only city smaller was Tonawanda, New York. And Tonawanda, New York played one game. We've now played over 1,000. So just the fact that this team has survived is nothing short of a miracle.
What were those early days like in forming the Green Bay Packers as we know it? What were discussions like? How did it get off the ground?
Well, most of our early history, most of it's just kind of been a muddled mess because people who were most qualified to write a book, like George Calhoun, the co-founder and the newspaper man at the Press Gazette, people like Lee Rimmel never did. So most of the books that have been written about our early history, have gotten it wrong. There was no advance notice in the Press Gazette before the first meeting. All we really know about the first meeting is that it was held on August 11, 1919, in the Green Bay Press Gazette editorial offices. It was the old building on Cherry Street. And other than that, we don't know much. The second meeting, we know that Curly Lambeau was elected captain. George Calhoun was made manager. And about 25 players attended. And from that point forward, the Press Gazette probably covered the team better than any other newspaper. In fact, it carried the team. It was more responsible than the Packer organization in keeping it alive for at least the first 10 years, maybe longer, partly because the Packers never had any employees other than Curly Lambeau and never had an office till 1949.
Wow. So the newspaper was really propelling the Packers forward and keeping the interest alive?
Yeah, it supported it in every way it could. George Calhoun was the city editor at the time. He was a sports fanatic. He was the great grandson of Daniel Whitney, who was the founder of Green Bay. And then his mother married a civil engineer who put in the water system in Green Bay, and so her husband Walter Calhoun traveled a lot for work. He was a civil engineer at that time. And so they bounced around a little bit. Calhoun ended up in Buffalo. That's where he went to high school. And he was an inveterate organizer there. You know, as early as 11 years old, he started organizing teams and then played a big role in the creation of the Packers, supported it from the beginning. And then when the franchise became a community property in 1923, Andrew Turnbull, who was the general manager at the time, really one of three owners of the Press Gazette, later publisher, was the one who spearheaded that effort. And I think it's...
And when you say a community property, what do you mean by that?
Well, when the first public, when shares of stock were first sold, when the Green Bay Football Corporation was established in 1923, that was the start of the Packers, as I said, being a community property. It was a nonprofit corporation structured much like the one today. That corporation did go into receivership in the 30s. There was a 17-month period.
Was that during the Depression?
Yeah, but the Depression really didn't have... It had something to do with it.
Okay.
Green Bay was largely unaffected by the Depression because of the industry here. No soup kitchens, bread lines, or anything like that. There were stories that... I've seen stories in Wisconsin newspapers about how the economy here was better than anywhere else.
So how was the corporation struggling in the 30s? Why did it go into receivership?
In 1931, a fan fell out of the stands at Old City Stadium and sued. And he sued for $20,000. He got five. The Packers insurance company was based in New York, and that had been shuttered because of the Depression. And so they had no insurance money. And, you know, at that point in time, the Packers were actually, they lived day by day, at least until 1950, maybe even into the 1950s. So they really had no money in the bank, and they went into receivership. The receiver had been associated with the team a long time. He was a local accountant. And years later, around the time of the 1950 stock sale, he said that when the judge appointed him the receiver, he handed him like 76 cents or whatever it was, very small amount, and $12,000 in debt bills.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Cliff Crystal, a historian for the Green Bay Packers. He's a Green Bay native who spent more than 36 years as a sports writer. You can join in with your Packer memories, your Packer questions from decades ago to the present. Join in at 800-642-1234. Cliff, tell us about, the Packers coming out of that era in the 30s and perhaps finding more footing in the 40s. Was it a more stable organization as you entered a new decade?
No, they struggled. Actually, in 1939, they won the NFL championship and they made like $1,000. Mm. Their net profit that year was, I think it was close to $1,500. Their season ticket base was, they set a, in the late 20s, they started an annual season ticket drive where people went, some of the civic leaders who were actively involved with the team would go out and try to sell season tickets because that was the money the seed money they needed really to start a season. And their goal was 1,000. To sell 1,000 season tickets, and that was as early as the late 20s, and they really never did it till the late 30s. There was, and in 1941, in fact, and by then the league was kind of, in the 20s, the Green Bay kind of fit in because there were still a lot of other small teams. Crowds were, average crowd was probably under 12,000. By the 40s, the league had grown, and it appeared that this league, it really had outgrown Green Bay.
Well, let's pause right there. Yeah, pausing right there with Cliff Crystal, historian for the Green Bay Packers. Your questions, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're commemorating 100 years of Packers history on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and with this look back, let's stop at Vince Lombardi, who coached the Packers to five titles, including the first two Super Bowls. 60 years ago, when he came to Green Bay, the tables turned.
All of the color, and all of the excitement, and all of the rings, and all of the money, these are the things that really linger only in the memory. But the spirit, the will to excel, the will to win, These are the things that endure.
What do you remember about Vince Lombardi? What's a quote from him that sticks with you, or one that you want translated? What do you think he brought to the Packers' history? Join in your questions for the historian, 800-642-1234. Green Bay native Cliff Crystal is the Packers' historian, and he's a sports writer in Wisconsin for more than 36 years. He stays with us. Cliff, as we went to break there, you were mentioning how back in the 40s, the league appeared to outgrow Green Bay. What happened?
Well, they were playing in a small wooden stadium in Green Bay, capacity 25,000. When they played the NFL championship game, that was the first that Green Bay, the Packers, hosted in 1939. They had to play the game at State Fair Park in Milwaukee, because the capacity, the stadium in Green Bay wasn't large enough, and the players would lose money because they got a good chunk of the gate. And then teams started, they felt like they were making more money. They were getting a bigger cut when they played in Milwaukee as opposed to Green Bay. So in 1941, Curly Lambeau went to the league meeting, and when he came back, the Bears and the Lions had agreed to play in Green Bay. Because they usually drew well,
mm-hmm.
and he hadn't completed his home schedule for the Green Bay games, because he couldn't find another team willing to come here. The Giants didn't play in Green Bay from, I think it was early 30s to late 40s. Washington, I think, was almost, it was early 30s to 1959. Some of the Brooklyn, Dan Topping, who eventually owned the New York Yankees, owned the Brooklyn franchise at that point. He absolutely refused, and Brooklyn never played in Green Bay. So a lot of teams were unwilling to play here. And that was a crucial test for the Packers in the early 40s. Interestingly, they thought that they were going to lose money. Curly wanted to keep the league going during the war. Packers, the executive committee was concerned they'd lose money, and they ended up making more. So they had record profits during the war.
During World War II.
Yes.
Well, let's take a call now. Paul joining us from Viroqua. Hi, Paul.
Yeah, hi. Hope you're having a good day. I had reached online about the very first person that played quarterback for the Packers was from Chicago. I don't remember his name. I was wondering what you might have to say about that.
Cliff, what about the first quarterback from Chicago?
Well, he wasn't from Chicago, because the first quarterback in 1919 was, the team was made up almost exclusively of players from Green Bay, East and West high school football players. Clement Dwyer, one of our great stories is a story about Dutch Dwyer. His brother Clement was the quarterback for the first game in 1919. He was a Green Bay West product. Ricky Dwyer was the end. His brother, he was working on the railroad late in the 1920 season, right before Thanksgiving, and he fell out underneath a moving train engine about 3 in the morning, and had to have an arm and a leg amputated. And this is where I think the love affair really started between town and team, and so they held a benefit game for him at the end of the 1920 season, raised about $5,000 to help pay his hospital expenses, drew a big crowd to Hagemeister Park for the game, and it's just a great, inspiring story. There's so many like that in our history. But anyway, it was his brother Clement, who played at Green Bay West, was the starter in that game. In the NFL, you know, by 1921, the Packers were still using most of those local players.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And then they were admitted to what was then the American Professional Football Association, what became the NFL in a year or so. And once they joined and once they played Minneapolis in that first game on October 23rd, 1921, they started recruiting players from all over.
That gave them much more visibility.
Yeah.
Let's
actually,
go.
You know, actually, Art Schmael was from, he may have been from Chicago. He lived in Chicago at one time. He was a Coast Guard officer. He played quarterback in our second game, but he didn't play it in the first game. And he may have been from Chicago, because right around that October 23rd date, they recruited a handful of players from other communities. They took some players from the Rock Island Independents.
Well, let's take another call now. Vicki in Wausau with memories. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. Thank you for this opportunity, and I appreciate Mr. Crystal as a historian. So this is kind of a current question. Every year when we go to Packer games and they have a $6 book you buy called Game Day, and in it gives a history of the Packers, and I don't know how much you're responsible for the current
the content
of it.
Yeah.
But there's only about two paragraphs in there about Vince Lombardi, and it's bothered me for years that they've minimized his history as far as the Packer organization. And there's probably a page and a half about Mike Holmgren, obviously a great deal about Coach McCarthy. And it's just, you know, I don't see them valuing what Lombardi did for them, because for many of us, he did save that franchise.
Vicki, thanks for the call. Cliff, help us understand the impact of Vince Lombardi on this organization.
Well, when the Packers were coming, they had just built a new stadium, 1957, and then they had that disaster. It's 1-10-1 year in 1958. I mean, everybody, I think once the stadium was built, this franchise became secure, but things could have changed dramatically, they continued in that direction. So Lombardi's impact was critical to our certainly legacy and maybe survival. Even then, I suppose there would have been a chance that the Packers could have folded had they not started winning, because they were in about longer than a decade's tailspin at that point. I still think he's the greatest coach in the history of the NFL. I think part of the reason, I'm not sure, I didn't write that, but I think what has happened in our media guide and maybe in that program that they sell at the stadium is that media guides used to be about, you know, probably less than 100 pages. And so each era they'd cover in a couple of decades. And what I think has happened is they've just added to it as the years have gone by. And now media guides are over, whatever, 500 pages, I think. And as they've just added more recent history. I don't think it's a slight at Vince Lombardi at all. I think our entire organization believes that, you know, between him and Lambeau, they are two of the biggest icons in the history of pro football.
Yeah, and you feel like that he should have certainly a stake in how we view the Packers today.
Yeah, I mean, we have a huge statue of him in front of Lambeau Field. I don't think he's been slighted at all. I actually, you know, the fortunate thing about the 60s Packers was that NFL film started around the same time. So that era has been captured on film. You know, we still have a lot of highlights people can look back and watch from that period, the Ice Bowl. Unlike the Cleveland Browns, who were winners in the 50s, kind of pre-television, and those great teams and great years that they had have been kind of overlooked by history because of the lack of video footage.
We're remembering 100 seasons of the Packers as the team was organized in August of 1919. Packers historian Cliff Crystal is our guide. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a shareholder with the Packers? Why do you own part of the team? What's it like? Do you attend the annual shareholders meeting? Where were you when the Packers have won a Super Bowl? What was that moment like for you? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Coming up, we'll move into more contemporary Packers history and bring us straight up to the present with Aaron Rodgers. That's after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.
Starr goes back to throw. Fires a pass complete to McGee. He's at the 30-yard line.
If you're just joining us, we're talking Packers history through the decades as we mark 100 seasons this month. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So here's Super Bowl 31, Packers behind the Patriots. But then Brett Favre sends a perfect pass to Antonio Freeman on the right sideline. Freeman goes the rest of the way for an 81-yard touchdown, at the time, longest in Super Bowl history.
Here's Antonio Freeman out here, and you just watch him right here. He starts out and he just runs right by his guy, and Brett Favre throws a perfect strike to him.
The longest touchdown pass in Super Bowl history.
What do you think of the Brett Favre era? How do you think he contributed to the franchise and how we view the Packers today? What questions do you have about Favre's greatest moments? We're at 800-642-1234. And Green Bay Packers historian Cliff Crystal stays with us. He's spent more than 36 years as a sports writer in Wisconsin, and he hails from Green Bay. Cliff, before we get to Brett Favre era, let's not forget Bart Starr's reign, 1956 to 71. He led the Packers to victories in the first two Super Bowls. Here's a moment. Let's hear from 1967's Ice Bowl.
17 to 14. Cowboys out in front. Starr begins the count. Takes the snap. He's got the quarterback sneak, and he's into the touchdown, and the Packers are out in front. And the Green Bay Packers are going to be world champions.
Take us back to the Ice Bowl. We understand it was very, very cold. What else there that sticks out to you from that 1967 moment?
Well, I was there. I was a 20-year-old college student. Mm-hmm. It was cold. I think that's probably the greatest drive, one of the greatest games in National Football League history. To score under those conditions, it was just very typical Bart Starr. I mean, those were his strengths as a quarterback. He was a field general. He was a leader. He was mentally tough. And it all showed on that drive.
So a stellar quarterback. What about his place as a coach, his coaching record?
Not so good. It was kind of a disastrous 9 years.
Why was that?
I don't think he had the experience for the job. He was given both, and beside that, he was given the positions of both general manager and head coach. As a general manager, the mistakes continued really until the end. I think as a coach, he got better as he got more experience. I covered those as a reporter, as a beat reporter. And it's just a lot of bad football.
Mm. Let's take another call now. Barbara joining us from Illinois. Hi, Barbara.
Good morning. I'm so excited to talk about the Packers. When you were asking if listeners were shareholders, I had to call for my daughter who's working, but she is a proud shareholder of one stock of Green Bay Packers. So she just returned to Wisconsin from Arizona, so hopefully now that she's back in the motherland, she will be able to take advantage of of Green Bay games.
She can be a more active shareholder.
Yes. And you were talking about Brett Favre. I've got a Brett Favre story if you want to hear it.
Go ahead, Barbara.
Actually, I've got two. Number one, when I went down to Mississippi, I tried to find the family, but I'll tell you, those people are loyal. No one would give me a bit of information, number one. Number two, I raised my family in Milwaukee, and my daughters both did summer work at the YMCA there in Milwaukee, and one of the trips was up to Green Bay. And the players, when they got up there, the players were just finishing their practice, and they had the kids sitting on the curb eating their lunch, and Brett Favre came out, and he was kind of in a bit of a hurry, and this one kid's lunch got run over.
Oh. Huh. Oh, well, at least they got to see Brett Favre coming out of practice.
Cliff... They did. Yes, they did.
Cliff Crystal.
So anyway,
Barbara.
My children love the Packers.
Cliff Crystal, it sounds like the Packers has really this family legacy and that there is so much family-oriented structure around who the Packers are as an organization.
Yeah, the team, somebody had the foresight, probably George Calhoun, almost from the start, to cater to kids. You know, we had so many traditions today, like the bike riding tradition, family night. You know, the bike riding tradition started in the 50s. Family night goes back to the 30s.
Remind us what the bike riding tradition is.
Well, the kids riding, the players riding kids' bikes from the locker rooms down to the practice field started, I believe, in 58, which was the first year the Packers held training camp out near the stadium. Although I've been told by a fan that the tradition had actually started when the Packers trained in Stevens Point prior to that from 1954 to 57, and I would believe it. But there's always been these wonderful traditions. In the 40s, it was at Old City Stadium. They'd let kids in for free, and a lot of them would go to the back gate and hook up with a player, and the player would put his arm around the kid's shoulder and take him through the gate, and then they'd just tell him to skedaddle and go find a place to sit and watch the game. At that point, they'd let kids sit in the back of the end zone, on the grass in the back of the end zone. So it's something the franchise has always done, always been aware of, and what better way to build a fan base when you're the smallest city in the league.
Let's bring in Nick now in Madison. Hi, Nick. What's your remembrance?
Well, quite a bit. My son was so inspired by Brett Favre. He went on to, you know, play baseball, football, basketball at a really high level. Actually, I think he kind of burned himself out by eighth grade. He couldn't really play anymore because he thought he was Brett Favre, I think. And just his playful and, you know, fearlessness out there, really, I love the Packers, but it's just not the same since those glory days of Brett. And a quick story, I was at the Super Bowl in New Orleans. We snuck into the Packers victory party afterward. After holding the Lombardi Trophy, we had to make ourselves our way across the French Quarter. And there was Brett throwing Mardi Gras beads to Mark Chimura to people underneath him on this balcony. He'd signal them out to run a pass pattern, you know, like over there, and he'd throw the Mardi Gras beads. Yep.
Nice. Yeah, I can see it now. Nick, thank you so much for that story.
Okay.
Cliff, what did Brett Favre bring to the Packers? How much did he contribute to the momentum of the Packers and the name recognition of it today?
Well, he revived the franchise. 1988, I believe it was, Frank DeFord, most respected sports writer in the country probably at the time, wrote in Sports Illustrated that maybe it was time for Green Bay to close up shop and move the team to Milwaukee. And that talk hadn't really been, nothing like that had been said since probably when the stadium was built in the 50s, maybe even the stock sale in 1950. It just, I don't think there's any question. Ron Wolf, Bob Harlan, Mike Holmgren all deserve a lot of the credit for that turnaround, but it was really remarkable. Most people didn't think the Packers would ever win again, and he was the guy who did it on the field.
What about his retirement? How did you see that as a historian looking it through that lens?
Well, I was a reporter at the time, and that's football. You know, Lombardi, Curly Lambeau, most players leave a team on bitter terms. Bart Starr was fired as a coach. That's just the nature of the game, the business of the game.
We're talking with Cliff Crystal. He's historian of the Green Bay Packers. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your remembrances. Let's go to Jim in Oshkosh. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. I renewed my season tickets for the 50th time on the Packers' 100th anniversary. And when I first started attending, the ticket price was $4.50. It's now $191 for my seats. But I saw the Ice Bowl, and I was at the Super Bowl in Texas. And I think I've seen it all.
You wouldn't miss it, Jim, even with the inflation, the change in the cost of the tickets. So Cliff, you know, Jim has been there all along, and the seats do get more expensive.
Yeah, again, I don't know that. I've been a season ticket holder. My family's actually had their season tickets since 1950. For many years, I sat in the press box, and I didn't use them. But I guess that's just, to me, it's just to be expected in this day and age. I paid a lot more for the Paul McCartney concert.
Jim, what do you love about going to Lambeau and taking in the games?
Well, it's first of all, I've been there through good times and bad times, and it's good to see the good times back. But it just it's a thrill to be there to see games from City Stadium to the current Lambeau Field. They're a legend.
Well, I think that kind of sums it up there, Jim. Thank you so much for calling in. We're appreciating 100 seasons of the Packers. We're moving through the history, the milestones of green and gold with Green Bay Packers historian Cliff Crystal as our guide. How long have you been a fan of the Packers? Like Jim, have you been going to games for decades, renewing those season ticket packages? What attracts you to this team versus another NFL team? Are you a new fan of the Packers? Why did you decide to start following the team? Did you inherit your love of the Packers from your family members? And how does your family take in Sunday games? What are your traditions? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute for more Packers here on the Ideas Network. It's a tribute hour to the Packers. 100 seasons of history this month. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we are moving through those 100 years all the way up to the present. Enter Aaron Rodgers on the scene. The Packers chose him in the first round of the 2005 NFL draft. And after he was drafted, he sat behind Brett Favre for 3 years and took over in his fourth season. Here he is last season, connecting with Randall Cobb for a 75-yard winning touchdown against the Bears.
Rodgers surveying, fires. That's caught. Randall Cobb into Chicago territory. Randall Cobb inside the 20-yard line. Randall Cobb is going to score.
What do you think of Aaron Rodgers? What do you see as the possible succession plan there? What will that future look like for the Packers? What challenges lie ahead? And what do you see as the opportunities? Packers historian Cliff Crystal stays with us. You can join in 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Sue now in Brookfield. Hi, Sue.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a long history with the Packers because in the 1897 team, my grandfather played. And, of course, this was before they were really the Packers. But I was at the corner drugstore one day when I was in my teens having lunch, and I looked up and I thought, gee, that man in the picture looks familiar. He looks like my father. I didn't even know that he played football at that time. I didn't know my grandfather. But also, some of the things that I remember, it was so hard to get people to go to the old county or city stadium or to see the team that they were giving away gifts. You'd get a ticket when you went in, and then if they called your number. And my mother won a casserole filled with Joanne's spices, uh-huh. And I still have the casserole.
You still have the casserole dish.
Yes. My uncles, my grandparents lived only a block away from the city stadium, and so they would park cars in their yard and sell programs. And I was quite young, and I asked if I could help sell programs, and they said yes. And some people came up to me and said, how much, 2 bits? And I said, no, a quarter. I didn't have a clue that there was a difference. You could also, in the old city stadium, even though my parents had tickets there, they also went beyond that. You could walk up to somebody and say, can I come in the game with you? And they would just let anybody come in. You didn't have to have a ticket when you were a child.
Sue, thank you so much for those memories. Cliff, how has the stadium and the area around it been transformed?
Well, she's talking about the old city stadium, mm-hmm. which was behind East High School. And I assume she is. It sure sounded like it to me. I think that the game that they gave away a lot of prizes was the Thanksgiving Day inter-squad game in 1949 that they hurriedly had to put together to just to finish the season because they were facing $90,000 in debts or a $90,000 loss that season. I think even Ron Wolf told me when he came to town, he thought that the Packers started play out near where Lambeau Field is today, but that's not the case. They started playing there in 1957, and obviously that area has changed. It was on the fringe of town then.
So as you look at Lambeau today and Aaron Rodgers at the helm, do you think that there is extra pressure on Aaron Rodgers to win a Super Bowl this year?
I don't know. I guess the NFL players, quarterbacks, are under, I think, very similar pressure every year.
Yeah.
That's the goal in the game. I don't know that it's any greater just because fans want it more.
What do we know, if anything?
That's what they play for, to win the Super Bowl.
What do we know, if anything, about his relationship with the new head coach, Matt LaFleur?
I'm really not aware of what... I've been so tied up in our history project, I really haven't even gotten out to
practice. You've been so busy with the past that you haven't really looked at what's happening in the present.
Yeah,
that's fair. That's absolutely fair.
anytime there's a coaching change, obviously there's some catch-up time for a team, learning a new system and so forth, but...
Well, let me ask you this. How has Aaron Rodgers evolved as a quarterback since when he first started with the Packers in 2005?
Well, he sat on the bench for 3 years, as you noted. And I think a lot of people, when the change was made, certainly didn't have the expectations that he's produced. I think he's probably the best passer in the game today. It's certainly him or Tom Brady. Maybe one of the most accurate passers in the history of the league. I think he throws on the run better than any other quarterback. I'm not so sure. I know everybody wants to gauge quarterbacks or measure quarterbacks and their legacy based on how many Super Bowls they win. I'm not convinced that's the best barometer. And I say that because Tom Brady's won more Super Bowls when he was a young quarterback and nobody expected him to, and more now as he's reached the age of 40 than he did in the prime of his career. Well, why not? And Peyton Manning, he won a quarterback. He won a Super Bowl at the end of his career. Certainly on the downside of his career.
Well, Cliff, you know, we talked earlier about the Packers' financial struggles early, you know, early on. How has the business side of the team changed?
Well, the Packers, the first season they played on an open field in Hagemeister Park. No fence or bleachers. And George Calhoun passed a hat to raise a little bit of money, pay some bills. And it's the, you know, biggest sports industry, I'm guessing, and certainly in North America today. I think that says it all from where, especially as it relates to the Packers, from where we started to where the game is now. I think anybody who was at those early meetings in 1919, it would blow their mind to see what this team has grown into.
You were saying earlier how there was a lot of history that it was either not recorded or perhaps recorded incorrectly. What is your toughest challenge as the historian? What do you grapple with?
Well, we'd like to get that right. We have such a great story. I say it's the greatest story in sports, and maybe somebody could argue that Jackie Robinson's story was bigger or better, but I also think that was bigger than a sports story. There's no other story like the Packers. That the fact that they survived is basically a miracle. And not only that, they've been the sixth most successful team in the history of the league.
Well, we have time for just a quick call in. Elaine in Colfax. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. I've been lucky enough to have been to a few games and practices. And the experience of going to Lambeau is really extraordinary. People are so warm. There's a lot of fun. There's a lot of creativity. People are throwing around footballs. There's people with musical instruments, like a little brass band or something, walking around. And if you're from somewhere outside of the area, people, you know, talk to you and ask questions, and it's like a big festival. And then when you go inside Lambeau, it is quite beautiful. I they say there's not a bad seat. Believe me, there's not a bad seat. it's really well designed, and it, like I said, the warmth of the place takes you away from all your problems just for a little while. It's very fun.
Well, Elaine, it's lovely to end on that. Cliff, final thoughts?
It's a shrine to pro football, certainly a shrine to our franchise. There's no other stadium like it in the National Football League, and I think if you're going to, you know, maybe the charm of it is similar to what they have in Boston with Fenway Park and Chicago with Wrigley Field, but, it's a great place to watch a football game.
Well, Cliff, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Cliff Crystal is historian of the Green Bay Packers. He's a Green Bay native who spent more than 36 years as a sports writer in Wisconsin. Just ahead, it is On Point. Tracking and selling our data becomes a business model. On Point. We'll look into that. That's just ahead. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.